Welcome to Vineyard 61's weekly podcast. We hope you'll be inspired, challenged, and encouraged by this week's speaker. For previous messages, go to our website, vineyard61.org, or subscribe via iTunes or SoundCloud.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Philip. Welcome to your weekly Vineyard 61 sermon. Good morning, everyone in Westside. Good morning, everyone in Balham. Good morning, everyone in Battersea. And as I promised I would, good morning, everyone at home, especially the little enclave down in Brighton. Good morning to you. Now, where shall we begin? Let's begin here. We're going to play across our sites a little game. It's a game I like to call I Spy, the silent rhetorical monologue version. It's a really great game where I'm going to say things and give clues, and you're all across your sites going to stay silent until I tell you to speak so I can make my point, okay? Now, if you're in church this morning in one of our sites, then you might be able to do this game for real. If you're not, you're going to have to use the magic of your imagination and put yourself in a church somewhere. Maybe you haven't been to a church, in which case imagine what a church might be like. Put yourself in your mind's eye, or for real, inside a church. Okay, you ready? I spy with my little eye something that should be disturbing and unsettling. And I don't just mean Steve. So if you want another clue, imagine you're real. This thing, which might be, should be disturbing and unsettling, has had this said about it. This should be as far removed from a civilized person, but from their thoughts, their eyes, and their ears. For it's not only the actual occurrence of this thing, but the very mention of it that is unworthy of a civilized person. It's your first clue. Remember, silent rhetoric monologue. Second clue, to give you an idea, if my dubious statistics, which are almost certainly incorrect, but I'm going to go with it anyway, if they are correct, this thing might be found printed on 1 in 50, maybe, people's bodies in the church. There's your second clue. And then your third clue is this. This thing was the main symbol of only the second piece of jewelry I bought my best friend in all our 10-year relationship together, and I got it for Christmas. So now, across your sites, feel free to shout out, what is the answer to my I Spy? Any ideas? If you said the cross, well done. 5 points to Hufflepuff. Because we go to churches. Some of us get tattoos. Others of us wear jewelry. All with the cross front and center. But the cross, lest we forget, is a first century device, heavily used by the Romans and the Persians for the infliction of death, humiliation, and public shame. Isn't that a bit weird? You might have heard this entry line before, but I'm using it again to begin this teaching series on the cross of Jesus with the hope that we might unsettle ourselves and become a bit more uncomfortable with it for a short time. Because my sense, myself included, is we've become awfully comfortable with the cross, often to the point of apathy. And my hope is through this series, we can unsettle ourselves in the short term so we might re-find a place of awe, of gratitude, and inspiration. And let me draw this whole series into one maybe single question. And a single question might be asked like this. Why is this device for public shame, torture, and death a symbol of hope for billions of people around the world? But in reality, that's not actually the right question. Because crucifixion, the act of being killed publicly on a cross, wasn't actually very uncommon in the time when Jesus was on the earth. In 519 BC, King Darius I, king of Persia, the same king mentioned in the book of Ezra, is said to have crucified 3,000 political opponents. And in AD 66, so just after, well, 30 or so years after Jesus' death, when the Romans came and finally fully ransacked and invaded Jerusalem, it was reported historically that they crucified so many Jews, they ran out of wood. So the question is not so much the way I posed it a moment ago, but the question is how this horrific, often tortured device that Jesus died on became a symbol of good news. So here is our operating question for this series. Why is the crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth a symbol of hope for more than 2 billion people across the world today? And this is our follow-up question for us individually. Is the crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth a symbol of hope for you? Just sit with that for a minute. I wonder what your answers might be. So friends, this is our introduction to the five-week series, as Viv was talking about, on the meanings of the cross of Jesus. Now, for those of you who want to go deeper than we will over this sermon series, there's two recommended books that I will tentatively offer you. They are Karen Sturrock-approved books, so you know they're excellent. I would warn you, neither are short, and in fact, neither fully agree with each other, but both are excellent. The one on the left on the screen there is by Tom Wright, How the Revolution Began. It's just a minor 450 pages. And the second one by Fleming Rutledge, her book, is just a 700. So I would recommend them in a sense of if you're the kind of person who, especially through this series, just feels that sense of call and you love to go into that level of depth, I would strongly recommend both of those if that's something that is helpful for you. But what then are we going to do? We're not going to read those books this morning. What are we going to do for the rest of our time together? Well, actually, what I wanted to do is something we don't often do in church together. We're actually going to read a long stretch of the Bible out loud together. We're going to read the story of Jesus' crucifixion according to the Gospel of Luke. And what we're going to do is I'm going to read out some sections of the story and invite you to read it with me, and across your sights or at home, feel free, I would love you to join me as we read them through. And after each, I'm just going to offer us some simple observations, things about what we have read, which we can take forward and understand what maybe Luke is communicating about this story of Jesus. Now, my first draft of this would have taken about 50 minutes to go through, so I have selected various scenes, and I'll guide you through the narrative. But my hope for this series is it just occurred to me that there's an entire possibility, and myself included, that I'd go through Easter again and not actually sit down and just read the whole story of what happened. And so what I want us to do together is to read together and notice together what in the biblical writers, in this case particularly Luke, what is he telling us about this story, of this thing that actually happened. So if you'd like to invite... open your Bibles with me to Luke chapter 22. And we will start reading together. I'm going to start reading. It's on the screens. And again, you're welcome to read out loud with me across our sites. But you're welcome to just sit quietly as well. So we read from chapter 22, verses 1. Now the festival of the unleavened bread, called the Passover, was approaching, and the chief priests and the teachers of the law were working for some way to get rid of Jesus, for they were afraid of the people. Then Satan entered Jesus, called Iscariot, one of the 12. And Jesus went to the high priests and officers of the temple guard and discussed how he might betray Jesus. And the first thing to notice here is when. When did the crucifixion happen, Jesus' crucifixion? It happened during the Passover festival. The Passover was the annual celebration of the most significant and formative event in the identity of the people of God. It was when God intervened and saved his people from slavery and oppression of Egypt. We also know from the other gospel narratives that Jesus intentionally picked this time to head to Jerusalem for his death, where he knew he would finally be killed. And what we know from this, therefore, is some of the meanings of the past event of Passover are about to be repeated. The second short thing we can start to notice is Luke is very intentional from the beginning about framing this as a kingdom battle. As Luke puts it very clearly, Satan entered Judas, and this is where the death story begins. And the third thing to frame the rest of our reading is this. Jesus at this point is intensely popular with the crowds. It says here the religious leaders were afraid of Jesus because he was so popular, and they couldn't act because he was so loved. So let's keep those three things in mind, pocket them as we move on. So I'm going to jump ahead a little bit, and in the interim from where we read next Jesus recording, or the recording of Jesus' last meal called the Last Supper with his disciples, where we would have seen again Jesus aligning himself and his death with the Passover event. But we will pick up now at chapter 2, I think I said chapter 1 still, but verse 39, but it'll be on the screen. Luke 22, sorry, yeah, verse 39. And it says this, let's read again together across our sites. Jesus went out as usual to the Mount of Olives, and his disciples followed him. He withdrew about a stone's throw beyond them, knelt down and prayed, "Father, if you are willing, take this cup from me, yet not my will, but yours be done." An angel from heaven appeared to him and strengthened him, and being in anguish, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was like drops of blood falling to the ground. Just one thing I want us to notice here is in Luke's account very clearly the unity of the Father and the Son. There is no separation here at this point. Jesus is not acting alone of his Father's will, nor is the Father imposing a will on a powerless Son. Far from it, we see the Father send angels to minister and strengthen the Son. They are together in their Trinitarian nature in what is about to happen. So we'll continue on now from verse 47. Let's read again. While Jesus was still speaking, a crowd came up, and a man who was called Judas, one of the 12, was leading them. He approached Jesus to kiss him, but Jesus asked him, "Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss?" Then Jesus said to the chief priests, the officers of the temple guard, and the elders who had come for him, "Am I leading a rebellion that you have come with swords and clubs?" Let me keep going. "Every day I was with you in the temple courts, and you did not lay a hand on me, but this is your hour when darkness reigns." Then seizing him, they led him away and took him to the house of the high priest, and Peter followed at a distance. So already as we follow on, we have seen the religious leaders have turned against him. And now we have already seen that Judas, in his disappointment with who Jesus had appeared to be, had allowed Satan to enter him to begin the betrayal. One of his closest friends betraying him with a kiss. And now what we see, and Luke says it very subtly, the other gospel writers are clearer, and it says that only Peter remains. In other words, the rest of his disciples run and leave him. And it's really important to remember here, these are not simply his disciples. As Jesus speaks to them earlier in this, the sense of him running up to his death in John 15, Jesus says this to them, "Greater love has no one than this, to lay down his life for one's," what does he say? Does he say one's disciples? Does he say one's followers? No, he says, "Greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for his friends." Jesus was deserted by his closest friends. Another thing we can notice to start building these themes, if you like, turning up the volume, is a very clear second reference to the spiritual battle that is brewing. When Jesus, when they arrest him, Jesus says, "You can't do anything in the daytime and the light, but you're acting now in your hour when, quote, darkness reigns." I'm sure it is referring to a literal time of the day, but Luke is probably also pointing us more symbolically. Throughout scripture, when God speaks about he is light, and when the powers of sin, Satan, and death are talked about, it's symbolized by darkness. Luke is making it clear to us that darkness is rising and this clash of kingdoms is growing. So let us continue from verse 55 now. "And when some of those at the house of the high priest had kindled a fire in the middle of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat down with them. A servant asked him, seated there in the firelight, 'You look closely at him,' and said, 'This man was with him.' But he denied it. 'Woman, I don't know him,' he said. A little later, someone else saw him and said, 'You are also one of them.' 'Man, I am not,' Peter replied." Let me continue. "About an hour later, another asserted, 'Certainly this fellow was with him, for he is a Galilean.' Peter replied, 'Man, I don't know what you're talking about.' Just as Peter was speaking, the rooster crowed. The Lord turned and looked straight at Peter, and Peter remembered the word the Lord had spoken to him, 'Before the rooster crows today, you will disown me three times.'" I hope it's already clear by now, but Luke is layering on rejection after rejection after rejection. First, the Jewish leaders were the first to turn. Then Judas, one of his disciples. Then the rest of his disciples leave him after the garden. Now the leader of his disciples, the one who did follow at a distance, completely absolves himself of ever even knowing who Jesus was. I think we can forget in this moment that whilst Jesus was fully God on earth, he was also fully human. The level of rejection he is experiencing is emotionally devastating. I don't know how this is feeling so far, but as I said at the start, I want to just land us and soak us in the real, actual story. This is what happened. This is what Jesus went through. Let's continue from verse 66. "At daybreak, the council of leaders, elders of the people, both the chief priests and the teachers of the law, met together, and Jesus was led before them. 'If you are the Messiah,' they said, 'tell us.' Jesus answered, 'If I tell you, you will not believe me. And if I asked you, you would not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of mighty God.'" So already we've had these two references to the spiritual forces beginning to move against Jesus. But this third is significant because this is Jesus starting to show his power and standing his ground. Listen again and almost try and put yourself in the moment of these words from Jesus. "From now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the mighty God." This is kingdom talk. The Son of Man was Jesus' favorite reference to himself from the prophetic book from the Old Testament, the Hebrew scriptures of Daniel. It is all about God's kingdom, the hope of God's kingdom returning to earth in the form of a Son of Man to overturn and end the corrupt kingdoms of the earth. Jesus knows exactly what's happening right now, and he also knows how it ends. But crucially, he's not fighting violence with physical force. In this moment, he is living out the values of his kingdom, peace and righteousness. Amongst other things, I've heard it read, which I quite like, he's living out the Beatitudes that he spoke about in the Sermon on the Mount about what it's like to be in his kingdom. So we'll continue our story, and we're going to skip on a little bit before we get to our next reading. What happens is Jesus is sent before Pilate, the Roman regional ruler at the time, also before Herod. Both of them try them against what Jesus may or may not have done wrong. And both come back saying he hasn't done anything wrong. He hasn't broken any laws. And they want to try and set him free. However, especially for Pilate, the crowd in front of him continue to insist on Jesus being punished. So we'll continue now into chapter 23, I want to say. Yes, verse 22. Give you a moment just to find that. And it continues like this. For the third time, Pilate spoke to them. Why? What crime has this man committed? I have found in him no grounds for the death penalty. Therefore, I will have him punished and then release him. But with loud shouts, they insistently demanded that he be crucified, and their shouts prevailed. So Pilate decided to grant their demand. He released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, the one they asked for, and surrendered Jesus to their will. So just a few moments ago, in fact, a few days ago, Jesus was welcomed into Jerusalem in a royal messianic procession. Fast forward to where we are now, the religious leaders turned against him. His first disciple betrayed him. First of his disciples betrayed him. The rest of his friends ran away in fear. The leader of his followers decided to say three times he never knew him. And now those crowds have turned and are condemning him to death. And even the Roman powers relent and fail to protect him. Every single human in this story is rejecting Jesus and leaving him to die alone. And what I find really powerful about that last piece we read as well is just noticing the difference, particularly between Pilate and Jesus. I don't know if it's intentional, but Luke even includes the phrase, he gave Jesus over to their will. And I see a similarity there with the use of the will in Jesus' prayer in the garden. So where Pilate surrendered his human will to the will of the angry crowd to make his life easier, Jesus surrendered his human will to the will of the Father, even though it would end in his death, to make our lives easier. And if that wasn't enough, Luke includes this detail of Jesus' willingness to surrender his life comes to allow someone, Barabbas, the guilty person in prison, who had been rightly convicted, to be freed. Let's take a brief time out. How are you doing? How are you doing in Westside? How are you doing in Battersea? How are you doing here at Balham? Maybe you've had enough. And that's good, but we're not done yet. And that's kind of the point I was hoping to make. Not that you necessarily remember all of these things in this moment, but I was hoping even we could experience something today. This is a lot. The cross is not a three-point sermon. It's not even a five-week series. It's a real, historical, complex, multi-layered event with revolutionary implications. And yet most of us don't notice there's a cross in almost every church we walk into. But let's finish off the story of how Jesus dies. Verse 33. When they came to the place called the Skull, they crucified him there, along with the criminals, one on his right and one on his left. Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they're doing." Do you know that saying, character comes out of us when we're knocked down? Probably not, because I made it up yesterday. But I was like, there's some kind of line that kind of is about that, right? And I couldn't find it, so there's one. But it's kind of true, right? And so let's pause. This is Jesus, his character, the fullness of God in human form, in an absolute moment of destitution. And what does he say? He says, "Father, forgive them." I mean, who says that? By comparison, I turn into a monster if I haven't eaten for 3 hours. But this is Jesus. This is God. Even in this moment when every single human character has rejected him, betrayed him, left him to die this unjust death, he has compassion and he has love and he prays for them. And in this prayer, to me, it's saying he is still united with the Father. And Luke doesn't say, or Jesus doesn't say in this moment, who he's praying for. But as I said, I'm going to bet it was the religious leaders, it was his disciples, it was Pilate, it was the crowd. He was praying for the people who put him there. Okay, let's keep going. Verse 35. The people stood watching, and the rulers even sneered at him. They said, "He saved others. Let him save himself if he's God's Messiah, the chosen one." The soldiers also came up and mocked him. They offered him wine vinegar and said, "If you are the king of the Jews, save yourself." One of the criminals who hung there hurled insults at him. "Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and us." At the start of Luke's gospel, in Luke, roughly Luke 13, what's known as Jesus' temptation in the desert, Luke finishes it with this detail that I've always found very intriguing and noticed. It says, when the devil, which is another name for Satan, had finished all his tempting, he left Jesus until an opportune time. And the reason I'm fascinated is there's a couple of indirect references, but it was never very clear those times when Satan returned again to tempt Jesus. But have a look at this story. Those things, those three audiences were saying, the people watching, the soldiers, the criminals, they were saying, "Use your power if you are the Messiah. Save yourself, come down from that cross, and we will follow you." Is that not the same temptation, the same voice as Jesus had in the desert when Satan said, "Throw yourself off here and you'll be saved if you are the Son of God and people will worship you"? Is that not the same temptation as in the desert, or indeed the desert, as it says in front of me? So I think these are human words of the criminals, the soldiers, the onlookers. But I would be confident it's the voice of Satan. He's all over this story, according to Luke. Because he knows if Jesus comes down from that cross, which he could, the fight is over and Satan wins. Kingdom of sin, death will win. There will be no forgiveness of our sin. There will be no defeat of the power of sin. There will be no resurrection. There will be no release of the Holy Spirit and God's presence. There will be no new creation. There will be no return of God's kingdom to earth. If Jesus obeys that voice, there is no gospel. But this is Satan's last stand in this kingdom battle, and he chooses the time when Jesus is at his absolute weakness. So let's finish with our last reading from verse 44. Let's read together. It was now about noon, and darkness came over the whole land until 3 PM, for the sun stopped shining. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two. And Jesus called out with a loud voice, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." And when he said that, he breathed his last. So if I am right, and that was the voice of Satan to Jesus, tempting him again, then Luke doesn't waste much time in telling us what Jesus decided. He doesn't waste time in telling us how this kingdom battle is going to end. That temple curtain tearing is a powerful symbol of God's kingdom now returning to earth because of Jesus' choice. This curtain it talks about is the curtain that separated the people of God from the full presence of God. These were the conditions under the first covenant with his people, covenants required because of our sin and the power of sin in humanity. But Jesus' choice to go to the cross, to undertake this rejection, is what has released God's presence back into the world. Jesus stood firm and the true King won. And again, we can see in Luke's account, Jesus is still one with the Father at the end. This is the story of God together acting as one for our good. And breathe. That's the event. That's what happened. It's very interesting that Christian belief is grounded in a number of critical historical events. Our faith is a historical faith. And one of these is the crucifixion of Jesus, something that very few, if any, historical scholars doubt happened. This is real history. I'm going to give the leaders at our sites a warning to come up to lead our time after I've finished. But I don't have a big theological point in this opening sermon. You've noticed I've made about 26 theological points in passing, and we're picking up some of those over the next 4 weeks. But my call to you is simply a response to revisit this story. Revisit Jesus' cross. Read about it. Think about it. Draw about it. Write poetry, write music about it, pray about it, question it, notice it. In preparing for this series, I've read 1,500 pages of theological content on the cross and the resurrection. Because although we're talking about the cross a lot, these two are like magnets. You can separate them temporarily to talk about them, but they come together again. And the point is, in all that reading, I'm just blown away by the breadth and, in some ways, the unfathomable nature of the meanings behind what we've just read. The death and the resurrection. What happened and what it means. I will confess to being fond of what our Catholic sisters and brothers, how they refer to the cross. They refer to it as the Paschal Mystery. Paschal, because it comes from the Hebrew root word for Passover. We mentioned that earlier. And mystery, for me, because, as I said, the breadth, the depth, the height and the width of God's love for us shown on the cross is really hard to pin down. But that's what's so amazing about it. We started with this question. Why is the crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth a symbol of hope for more than 2 billion people across the world today? And we asked, is it a symbol of hope for you right now? So my call to you is if you're sitting here and you resonated even with my opening, that actually maybe you have got comfortable with this. Maybe you do have a sense of apathy or like, oh, it's just a cross. Then use these weeks to try, ask God to give you a new revelation, a fresh revelation, a reminder of what's going on here. And as I transition, I was talking to Viv the other day, and I was telling her a story, and she said, I think you should end with that story. About, I have no idea actually, 10 years, let's go with that. 10 years ago, I was at university at church. I was not at university 10 years ago, whatever. Here's a story in a point in time. I was at university. You can tell it wasn't very prepared. And I was in this place. I don't remember why, but I was sat in front of the cross and it meant nothing to me. Or at least I had the apathy. And I in that moment, I knew it wasn't where I wanted to be. And so I just sat in front of the cross, very emotionless. And I said, God, I need you to reveal, I need a revelation from you again of what this means. I can't work myself out of this. For me personally, I've been a Christian too long in one sense. I can't think my way back into a feeling of how this should feel. And I don't remember exact timings, but it wasn't instant. I was probably sat there for 15, 20 minutes as part of a service, just praying, like, you need to break this. And I don't remember exactly how and when it happened, but at some point, something happened, and I'm not a big dancer. And I just thought, something came over me, and I found my friend in the room who was one of those people who, completely different to me, we had a wonderful friendship because we were so different, and I was like, Darren, we have to go outside and dance. And again, I don't really remember what happened in the sense of it wasn't rational as such. And we didn't have shoes on. I think it might have been raining as well. And me and Darren went out and we danced on the pebbles. There were pebbles on the ground. It hurt. And all I can tell you is we just danced for like 5 minutes, just enjoy about the cross. I could not go outside and do that right now. And so what my hope was in finishing with that story, I'm going to hand back to Steve at Westside and Chris at Battersea, is if something has stirred in you this morning that you want to re-find the wonder, you want to find the meaning, the revelation, something different, something new about what the cross means, is to ask God. You know, beg him. I was begging him in front of that cross. This is not just theology. So I'll hand back now to Steve and Chris as they lead our ministry time this morning.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. Tune in next week for another life-giving message from one of our Vineyard 61 speakers.